If there's one question that I've been asked more than any other question, it would be this. What's the most important single message in the Conversations with God dialogues? Well, you might think that would be a difficult question for me to answer because the dialogues cover 9 books and well over 3,000, nearly 4,000 pages. What is the most important lesson, the single most important message of Conversations with God? Well, there are a lot of thoughts about that I have. But I'm going to tell you what was the most important to me. I think the most important to the world is the first lesson in the books itself, We Are All One. But here's the most important message to me, and I'll tell you how I came to that message first. In the Conversations with God dialogue, I was sitting on my couch. It was the middle of the night, 4:23 in the morning, and I didn't understand why my life wasn't working. And I couldn't grasp what the problem was. So I called out to God, in the middle of the night, what does it take to make life work? And what have I done to deserve a life of such continuing struggle? Somebody tell me the rules. I'll play, I promise, I'll play. Just give me the rule book. And when you give me the rule book, don't change them. Just tell me what I need to know. So I got to this place where I was calling out to God. Just tell me. And I remember that the answer that I got was almost like a chuckle. The voice of God, which I hear in my mind, sounds like the voice of my own thoughts, sounds like the sound of my own thoughts. The voice of God in my mind said, Neil, the answer is really very simple. Your life is not working because you think your life is about you. I said, well, of course I do. Of course I do. My life is about me. I'm not selfish. I'm not so self-centered that I don't consider anybody else, but of course my life is about me. It's about everyone, in my family and those I love. And of course, what else would it be about? And that's when I got this single message that I consider, for me, the most important message in Conversations with God. 6 words that really changed my life. I'll say them for you in German and hope I can get it not too bad. Dein Leben gibt nicht um dich. Or in English, your life is not about you. 6 words in both languages. Your life is not about you. It's about everyone whose life you touch and the way in which you touch it. That's not a thought that I had embraced or even considered before my Conversations with God. It really turned the whole axis of my experience completely around. It shifted everything. Like a lazy Susan. You know what a lazy Susan is? Where they put food on a circular turntable and they turn it around so that everybody can get some. That's what happened in my life. My whole life was just completely turned around. And I thought, no, wait a minute. How can that work? Your life is not about you. It's about everyone whose life you touch and the way in which you touch it. But I began to understand more deeply as I received more of the messages in Conversations with God. And I came to become aware that when you see every event in your life as an opportunity to do something for another, to offer something to another, to heal something in another, you will understand what you are doing here on the earth. And that's not something that most people understand. Most of us are not aware of why we are on the planet and what we are doing here and the purpose for all of life. And I've made that point before in prior lessons, because it's a central point of the Conversations with God messages of the conversations with God material. See, the problem is, we don't know who we are. We don't even know where we are. We don't know what we're doing here. And these become the four fundamental questions of life, by the way, that I encourage everyone to ask themselves at the beginning of their spiritual training, at least once a day. Once or twice a day, ask yourself what I call the four fundamental questions of life. Later on in your training, maybe once a week, once a month. And then when you really become a spiritual master, you don't have to answer the questions at all or ask the questions because you have already given yourself your replies. But here are the four questions that I tell you can change your life if you ask them at least once a day in the early part of your spiritual training. Question number one. Who am I? Who am I? Question number two. Where am I? What is this place? I don't mean what room am I in, or what city do I live in, or what house. I mean, where am I in the universe, in the cosmos, in ultimate reality? Where am I? Question number three. Why am I where I am? Why am I here? And question number four. What do I intend to do about that? What is my decision with regard to what I intend to do about that? Now, let's go back to question one. Who am I? What I've been told in conversations with God is that most of us, myself included, most of us are living a case of mistaken identity. We think we are human beings fighting for survival. That's what we think we are. Who am I? I'm a human being. What am I doing here? Trying to survive. Trying to get through as long as I can. What I don't understand until I had my conversations with God, I did not understand it, is that I'm not a human being. I mean, I am, of course, but that's not my largest identity. That's not my greatest definition. That's not my biggest identity. Who I am is a spiritual entity. I am a spiritual entity having a human experience. I know you've heard that before many places, but it's true. And the truth of it has impact in our lives beyond anything you might initially imagine. If I really am a spirit having a human experience, then all sorts of other truths about spirits become part of my human reality. The most important truth of which is this. Spirits never die. Spirits don't die. Death does not exist. Therefore, survival is guaranteed. So if I think that I'm a human being and I'm here trying to survive, I've got at least two elements drastically misunderstood. Huge misunderstandings. Number one, I'm not a human being, or at least that's not all I am. I'm much more than a simple human being. And number two, I'm not here trying to survive. My survival is guaranteed because I am a spirit that lives forever and even forevermore. I'm a spirit that always was, that is now, and always will be. But most people don't understand that. They don't know what they're doing here. I was told by God something very interesting. And I was told this in a number of ways, in a number of writings. A Course in Miracles puts it this way, and I loved what the Course in Miracles said about this. In A Course in Miracles it says, you have come to the room to heal the room. You have come to the space to heal the space. There's no other reason for you to be here. Could that be true? Could that be the reason that we're here on the earth? Could that be the reason that as a spirit, I exist on the planet? Let me repeat it because you may not have really caught the whole meaning of it. I'll say it again. What if it were true that You have come to the room to heal the room. You have come to the space to heal the space. There's no other reason for you to be here. You're not trying to learn anything. I know there's a popular notion out there that the reason we are here is to learn something. Life is a school, we're told. Life is a school. Excuse me, but no, it's not. Conversations with God has made it very clear to me. Life is not a school. We did not come here to learn lessons. God would not put us down here as a little baby, knowing nothing, and hoping that we learn our lessons fast enough so that we can survive. Survival is not even the basic instinct. We are told by anthropologists and others that the basic instinct is survival. Actually, that's not true. Survival is not the basic instinct. Conversations with God tells us that the basic instinct is the demonstration of divinity. So, if that's true, then we're not here to survive. We've come to the space to heal the space. We've come to the room to heal the room. There's no other reason for us to be here. I want to share with you what happened in my life when I began to understand that my life was not really about me. It was about everyone else whose life I touched and the way in which I touched it. Everything shifted. Everything changed in my life, and things started to work for the first time in my life. The reason that things aren't working on the planet right now is that the largest number of people, the majority of human beings, have no idea who they are or why they're here. They are living a case of mistaken identity. They have no notion of who they are. They don't see themselves as individuations of divinity, as singularizations of the singularity, as God made human in single form. They don't see themselves as that. They really do see themselves as members of the human species, members of the human race, and they do see their fundamental instinct as the instinct for survival. Let me tell you something. Before I get on to what I was going to say, let me share this. If survival were the basic instinct, nobody would run into a burning building to save the baby. You know what I'm talking about? If you're walking down the street and you look to the left and you see a building on fire, and you say, oh my goodness, the building's on fire. Then you hear a baby crying from the second floor. Do you know that 8 people, maybe 9 people out of 10, would run into that building to save that baby? They wouldn't sit there and weigh the options. They wouldn't go, let's see, should I go in or should I go out? Will I survive or will I not survive? Survival isn't even the question in moments like that. We simply run into the building to save the baby. It's what I call the burning building moment. And if survival were the basic instinct, we'd run the other way. We'd run away from the burning building. There was a man in New York City a few years ago who saw a little child, a 3- or 4-year-old toddler, walking out in the intersection, stepped off the sidewalk and stepped into the street, and a bus was coming. And he saw the child and he saw the bus. And he raced out. He was standing there and he raced out and he scooped up the child and he pushed the child away. He knew the child would have a scraped knee, maybe even a little bruise here and there from being thrown onto the, but at least he was out of the way of the bus. It didn't even occur to him, wait a minute, I could get killed here. He simply moved out there and pushed the child out of the way. Fortunately, the bus stopped just in time, just inches away from him, or he would have been killed. When the newspapers came by and the television stations, you know, and the people on the sidewalk were all applauding for his courage and his bravery, and they said, you're a hero, you're a hero. And he said, no. I did what anybody would do. Did you hear that? I did what anybody would do. And you would. If you saw a child running into the street and a bus was coming, you would do exactly the same thing. Because survival is not the basic instinct. The demonstration of the grandest notion of who you are is the basic instinct. the expression of divinity is the basic instinct. And so the answer to the first question, who am I, becomes very clear. We end our case of mistaken identity when we answer the first question, who am I? I am divinity in human form. But because we as a culture have not embraced that notion, because we have not accepted that as what's true, our lives are not working. My life wasn't working until I understood who I am and what I'm doing here. That my life is really not about me. It's about everyone whose life I touch and the way in which I touch it so that I could help them to understand who they really are and pass it on and pass it on and pass it on so that the human race as a collective could finally awaken. But because we don't understand what we're doing here, we don't understand who we are, nothing's working. Have you noticed, by the way, have you noticed that? Our political system is not working. Nothing is working the way we designed it to work. It's not producing the outcome it was designed to produce. Our political system around the world was produced with the hope that it would create unity, or at least peace, if nothing else, among nations. Some level of peace and harmony. But it hasn't done that. In fact, it's done exactly the opposite. Our economic system on the planet was produced with the hopes, at least, that it would provide, if nothing else, equal opportunity. Maybe not even equal financial standing, but at least equal opportunity. A fair chance for everybody. Yes? But it hasn't produced that outcome. In fact, it's produced exactly the opposite. Isn't that fascinating? Our ecological systems have been put into place to protect our environment and to produce sustainability on the planet. But guess what? It has produced exactly the opposite. An ecology that's unsustainable the way we are trying to operate it. Our educational system has produced exactly the opposite of what it was intended to produce. We are hoping that it would produce a higher level of awareness and knowledge, shared knowledge on the planet. What's happening now is the dumbing down of human beings. You know what? We can't even remember the telephone numbers of our own family anymore. When I was 7 years old, I could tell you the telephone number of my grandmother, my aunt Irene, my uncle Jim, everyone on my father's side. I knew the telephone numbers in my head. I also knew how to make change. I could actually make change without a cash register, without a computer in my hand. I could actually make change. You could give me a $20 bill for something that cost $14.46, and I could actually make the change for you. That's how my mind was working when I was a young person. These days, I couldn't tell you. We can't tell each other. I can't even know my own telephone number. See, I have to look up my own telephone. Oh, yes, that's right. So the educational system in the world has produced exactly the opposite. The dumbing down, not the raising up of our collective intelligence. All of the systems we've put into place are no longer working the way they were intended to work. Our healthcare systems were put into place to raise the level of healthcare that's available around the world, to increase the percentage of people who had access to modern medicines and modern medical procedures. It's done exactly the opposite. The percentage of people who find it possible to access the greatest medical care and the most marvelous medicines is reducing. Fewer people, as a percentage of the whole, can access those modern medical miracles. Our social systems, created to produce harmony among people of all races and all cultures and all religions, have produced exactly the opposite results. Increasing rage and increasing conflict between people of different races, cultures, and religions. And saddest of all, most dysfunctional of all, are religious systems put into place in order to make us feel closer to God and closer to each other, have done exactly the opposite. They've made us feel further away from God and further away from each other. How is it possible that every one of the major systems we've put into place on this planet to make life better for us all has made life worse for us all? Is it possible, just possible, that there's something we don't fully understand here? The understanding of which would change everything. Of course it is. Not only it's possible, it's obvious. There's something we are simply not understanding. And what we're not understanding is who we are, where we are, why we are where we are, and what we have the opportunity to do about that. So let's go over the answers to those questions very quickly. Who am I? An individuation of divinity. Where am I? In the realm of the physical. That's where I am in the universe. I am in this place called the realm of physicality, or the realm of the physical, as opposed to the realm of the spirit, or the realm of the metaphysical. Why am I where I am? What am I doing here? I am in the realm of the physical because in the realm of the physical, things exist relative to other things. It's also called the realm of the relative. In the realm of the physical, or the realm of the relative, things exist relative to other things. There's up and down, black and white, big and small, fast and slow, good and evil, male and female. Things exist, light and dark, in relationship to each other. And it's only in that kind of environment that I can decide who I am and experience it. I couldn't experience who I am if I'm in the realm of the absolute. And the realm of the spirit is the realm of the absolute, where things exist in absolute form. It is always here. It is always now. There is only love. Love is all there is. In fact, all there is love here and now. That's all there is. But in order for me to experience that, to express it, I would have to place myself deliberately and intentionally in a realm called the realm of the relative, where things exist relative to other things. To give you a simple, very simple, quick example, if I say I am the light, I am the light. I can't experience myself as the light. I can know myself as the light. I can understand myself intellectually to be the light, but I can't express it. I can't experience myself as the light. Unless there is what? Darkness, of course. If I am the light amidst the light, I am like a candle in the sun. I'm there, okay. I'm there, but I can't be experiencing myself because I'm just the light amidst the light, in the light. So I would call forth the darkness in order to experience myself as the light. Yet what's interesting on this planet is, having called forth the opposite of who we are, we condemn it. We condemn the very thing that makes it possible for us to experience, to express, and to understand who we really are. That's what we don't understand, the understanding of which would change everything. So who are we? An individuation of divinity. Where are we? In the realm of the relative. Why are we in the realm of the relative or the realm of the physical? So that we can express and experience who we really are. What do we intend to do about that? That's the question you will answer with the living of your life. But you will answer it most profoundly, most effectively, and most efficiently, and most rapidly, most quickly, when you grasp the notion that your life is not about you in the small sense. Your life is not about the individual, individuated you here. It's about universal you, the total you. And so, in the individual sense, your life is about everyone else whose life you touch and the way in which you touch it. When you understand that, you see everything differently, including the challenges and the difficulties of your own life. You begin to welcome those challenges and difficulties, even as you, in a sense, welcome the darkness that comes into the space of your life, what you would call the darkness, because you see that it is in the moments of the darkness that you can experience yourself as that which is the light. So you allow yourself to notice and to welcome, even to bless, those things that we once called the darkness. Does that make sense? Who would agree with that? People are listening to this right now, watching it, saying, oh, Neil, it's nonsense. You're not going to actually bless the darkness, the bad things that happen in your life. Who would suggest such a thing? Well, it was one person who did. He actually said, bless your enemies. And pray for those who persecute you. And be a light unto the darkness. Raise not your fist to heaven and curse the darkness not, but be a light unto the darkness, that you might know who you really are. See, we were told these things thousands of years ago, and not just by the man called Jesus. The man called Buddha told us that hundreds of years before Jesus. Buddha said, even if you should be attacked on the side of the road, and your attackers would take all of your clothes and all of your worldly possessions and beat you and leave you there to die, even then, if you have one negative or angry thought toward that person, you have not heard my teachings. What kind of a person says that? Only a person who understands who they really are, why they're here, and that they need nothing to survive, because survival is not the issue, because their survival is guaranteed. The question is not whether I will survive, but what shall be the form in which I survive. That is, what will be my experience of myself during my everlasting and eternal survival. That becomes the question. When survival is not the issue, we rise to our highest self. We push the toddler outside, away from the bus. We rush into the burning building. And we respond to the better angels of our nature. But you could not do that if you thought you needed something in order to be happy or in order to survive in your life. You would have to eliminate the idea that you need anything. Another central point of the Conversations with God material. You don't need anything at all in order to survive, because your survival is guaranteed. You don't even need anything in particular to be happy. Happiness is a state of mind that is embraced and created out of our understanding that I need nothing in particular to happen or to occur or to be in my possession in order for me to be full of joy and in order for me to experience grandly who I am. When I understand that I need nothing, that need is an illusion, then I'm really clear that my life is not about me, but really about everyone whose life I touch and the way in which I touch it, because a lot of people out there are not clear about what we're talking about. They do think they need things. But here's the magic of not needing anything. Here's the magic of thinking and being aware that you need nothing to survive. You need nothing in particular even to be happy. But some people think that they do. When you supply them with what they imagine themselves to need in order to be happy, you bring yourself the experience of having it. Did you hear what I just said? The experience of having something you need to be happy is not gained by obtaining it, by acquiring it, but just the opposite, by giving it away. When you give something to someone else, that's when you have the tactile physical experience of having it. I can't give anything to anybody else unless I have it. Let me give you an example from my life. This is an important example. Once in my life, about 30 years ago, but it was a vivid example, so I recall it to this day, a young man came to me. He said to me, Neil, I need your help. I'm in deep financial trouble. I can't make my mortgage payment. I'm going to lose my house. It's the third month in a row that I've missed my mortgage payment. They're going to repossess my house. The bank wants my house. Can you possibly help me? I've been out of work. I've been out of work for 6 months. I know you have a good job. Maybe you have some money. Maybe you could help me. This was a good friend. He wasn't just a casual acquaintance. But I had to look at my friend in the face and I said, you know, I don't know what to tell you. I don't have it. I can't give it to you. I don't have a lot of money right now. I spent a bit. I just bought a car. This, that, the other thing. I I don't have a lot of money in the bank. I couldn't possibly cover 3 months of mortgage payments for you. He said, I understand. I'm sorry to have burdened you with this. I understand. He said, I'll make out somehow. And he left. But it weighed on me. I thought, oh gosh, I wish I... So I took all the money that I had in the bank. It wasn't as much as he needed, but it was, you know, I took the money out of the bank. But then I asked some people as well. I asked some people that I knew, including my own father. I asked him, could you maybe give me a little loan? I'll pay it back in 6 months. He said, certainly. And he gave me a loan. I got some money for some friends. I even remembered a person who owed me some money, actually. And I called him to remind him. I said, you know, I hate to be a bad about this, but you owe me, you know, a little bit of money here. And he said, you know what? It's really strange, but I actually forgot. He said, because you never asked for it. I can give it to you. And before I knew it, I had all the money this guy needed. I called him on the phone the next day. I said, you're not going to believe this, but I managed to get the money together. Here's 3 months of mortgage payments. Pay your mortgage. Get caught up on your payments. Save your house. The man came to my apartment. You know, of course he was in tears. I can't believe this. I thought you didn't have it. I said, you know what? I thought I didn't have it either. But here it is. To me, that was the most vivid demonstration. To this day, I remember what I learned. When you choose to be the source of what it is you want to receive, you have the experience of having it. And when you have the experience of having it, your mind gets very clear and you wind up creating more and more and more of it. The perfect example in your life is love. That's the perfect example. You want to have love? Give love. And guess what? The more love you give, the more love you will have. I promise you. That's how life works. My dear, dear friends, you can embrace all of these notions and wrap them up in one simple principle when you understand that your life is not about you. It's about everyone whose life you touch and the way in which you touch it. Move through life with clarity about that and clarity about who you are and why you're here, and watch your life become a miracle. Well, you know, I just concluded what I wanted to say about your life is not about you, it's about everybody else whose life you touch. And something occurred to me as kind of a afterthought that I wanted to share with you, because it was very important in my life. From the time I was a child, all I heard from my culture, from my parents, from my religion, from my school, all I heard was this famous statement, it's more blessed to give than it is to receive. It's more blessed to give than it is to receive. But you know what? At 14, as a 14-year-old child, I didn't get it. As a 24-year-old man, I didn't get it. As a 34-year-old man, I thought, well, that sounds nice. I mean, it's very sweet. It's more blessed to give than to receive. But, yeah, I don't get it. I don't get the foundation of that. It's, you know, more blessed in whose mind? In God's mind? But no one ever explained the metaphysics of it. And by the metaphysics of it, I mean the physical and metaphysical interaction that causes that statement to be profoundly true. It is more blessed to give than to receive, because according to the metaphysical principles that were explained to me, finally in conversations with God, I understood that what you give, you do receive. That what goes around comes around. That it is by giving that you receive. I mentioned this a little bit in the lesson that I just finished, but I didn't quite understand, why doesn't everyone tell us this when we're small children? Why isn't the metaphysical truth of life, the fact that this is a mechanical thing, this is not a nice thought, a sweet idea, or what God says, you know, I will reward you. It's not that at all. This is a simple explanation of the mechanical function of the universe. This is the machinery by which life functions. As you give, so shall you receive. That's why you are more blessed when you give. If you spend your life trying to get, receive this, you spend your life stressing and straining to gather all these things you need to be happy. Beginning tomorrow, seek to gather nothing. Don't try to reach out for anything. When you reach out to give. And as you give to others, watch your own abundance, your own joy, your own happiness, your own supply of everything you thought you were trying to obtain. Watch that supply increase dramatically, because that's how the machinery works. That's the metaphysical truth of life. And no one ever told me that until I was 50 years old, and I found it in conversations with God. I hope you find it to be true in your life as well. Give it a try.